Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Okay, welcome back to the Gay Buddhist Fellowship. We will go around and introduce ourselves. My name is Cass.
Jordan.
Matthew.
Stephen.
My name is Jerry.
Shinsen.
Marcus.
My name is Henry.
I'm Grant.
I'm Brad.
I'm Grisha.
Jack.
I'm Richard.
I'm Tony.
I'm going to switch over shortly to our speaker today, who is Reverend Kiryu Lien Shup, who is a lineage holder in the Shinryu Suzuki tradition. Born to a Buddhist family of Vietnam, she received her meditation training in the Insight and Zen traditions in the U.S., Thailand, Japan, and Vietnam. She was a founding member of the Buddhists of Color in 1998 and currently is the guiding teacher of Access to Zen, an anti-racist, inclusive sangha and nonprofit in the SF Bay Area. She lives in San Francisco with her partner, exploring waterways and forests as often as they can. Their website is accesstozen.org. I want to welcome you very much, Ian, dear friend to our sangha.
All right. Thank you, Cass, for the intro. Hi, everyone, and everyone online. Nice to be back with you all. It's been a little bit. My name's Kiryu Lien Shup. Blanche Hartman, of course, was my teacher, and I know she was part of you all for a long, long time. And so always happy to be here. My pronouns are she and they. And my current teacher is Vicky Austin, who you all may also know from San Francisco Zen Center, and also Gil Fronstall. All right, so yesterday, or this weekend really is, not all the time really, but we celebrate or we mark Earth Day yesterday, so that's what I wanted to talk about. And in particular, about the deep climate crisis that we are in. We just had the atmospheric river, and so our drought is now over, except for in California, most of California. And yet, we well know we're kind of at that extreme drought, and I even heard not too long ago that they thought by 2030 we'd be like Arizona, very, you know, dry. And now, I don't know, after the atmospheric river, I was thinking, oh, maybe we got it wrong. We're going to be like the Great Lakes or something. Right? So things have really changed, and they're saying that the extremes are going to be that much more. And in fact, 2022 was the second warmest year ever recorded. This is from the World Food Program and NGO. In particular, we felt it here, and I think like the flood in Pahara, as I pronounce that town, you know, really affected people. And so we have some sense of its effect here, and in other parts of the world, the effect is really devastating to even broader extreme, such as last year, the whole Horn of Africa area was in a huge drought, and of course we've heard about droughts in Africa for years and years and years. And then one-third of Pakistan was underwater. And even since January this year, lots of countries in Europe had the warmest record in January, right? In January. Mm-hmm. So the World Food Program provide food and other assistance to over 160 million people, including many hit by climate disasters, and in over 30 countries they serve. And they think everyone realizes that the climate crisis will actually make this become even more extreme. So how are we with this? I know that for myself, as you can just hear in my sigh, I'm often really overwhelmed by it all. And I listen a little bit, and then I, you know, carry on with my day. And it's really hard to be with. So I wanted to talk about a bit about how to be with it. And in fact, our practice is to be with, right? The first noble truth, in essence, is how are we with things. For most of us, that means difficulties, because being with the easy things seem really easy. As some of you know, I don't remember if I brought it up here, I've been reframing the Four Noble Truths to be a restorative model, supported by the Homeric Foundation, a Buddhist foundation. And so in that model, the first noble truth is we say that harm and harming has happened. You know, not just that there's harm in life or that there's dukkha in life. So dukkha is usually translated as suffering, disease, discontent, dissatisfaction. And so in this model, we really say we feel the impact of harm, or harming or hurt. And then the second is really similar in the sense that it's what are the causes and conditions or the origins of dukkha. And in this case, we focus a bit more on the conditions and in particular structural conditions versus just personal or individual conditioning. And then the third is usually in the classic version that the end of suffering is possible or the alleviation of suffering is possible. And the fourth is that the Eightfold Path is to be developed. So in the engaged version, we say that the third noble truth is that individual and collective agency for ending or alleviation of harm is possible. So we really connect to how there's agency, there's a way that we can do something about it. I also like to call it these days I've been thinking of the third noble truth as the goodwill or the you know, the New Testament, I could say, right? The good news, right? That's a Christian thing, right? Because really, when you think, oh, it's possible, we don't just get stuck in the suffering and the dukkha, we go, oh, it's possible, and that brings us joy, and it's like the good news. And in fact, in Buddhism, then the Eightfold Path gives us the way to know what is possible for the end of suffering and a way to do it. So I like to say that the fourth noble truth or the Eightfold Path is both descriptive and prescriptive, right? And they are, of course, and they're broken, well, they're eight, they're broken to three aspects, right? Wisdom, usually called wisdom, ethical conduct, and meditative. So the wisdom, so while they're eight, they're broken into two in the wisdom aspect, which is skillful view. So classically, of course, we know them as right. With right, by right it means the correct way. And I'll just say the Thanissara Bhikkhu, I heard say that right, the way that he explained it, is that right is like when you go to milk a cow, you don't pull on its tail. Right. So the right way is to pull in the udder. So it's that. But and in a lot of ways it gives us that connotation of right and wrong. So I myself like to say skillful, because skillful gives you a sense of what is skillful and it gives you a sense of how to be skillful. So it's both a knowing and a motivation, which actually describes wisdom aspect. Because the wisdom aspect is Skillful view is the Four Noble Truths and karma. The understanding of the Four Noble Truths and karma, cause and effect. And then the second of the wisdom aspect is classically called skillful thinking. And the word does mean thinking, but it's in Buddhism, thinking is never passive. It's always moving. So motivation is what I use, and it's become popular. I would say gyo is these days even say it's an attitude. And now it's important to understand that, because the wisdom aspect, and I also think this is why I like skillful motivation, is that it takes you into that second third, which is ethical conduct, which I like to say compassionate conduct, because those are skillful speech, skillful action, and skillful livelihood. Right? So how we understand the world, what is our motivation, takes us into the interactive and the activity part. And then the last third is skillful effort, skillful mindfulness, and skillful concentration. Right? And these are called the meditative aspects. Now, while they're put into third in this way, the meditative aspect is actually considered the bridge between the other two thirds. For instance, these are my values and my motivation. In meditation, where it's not a passive practice, it's a practice to say, does my action, my living, my speech reflect my wisdom and my understanding? Or I've acted a certain way, I sit down and I think, ooh, was that in accordance with my values and my wisdom, right? So the meditative aspect is really there to kind of settle us and help us settle or connect to or to be in alignment or to have the integrity of both living by our wisdom and clarifying our wisdom through our action. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. If not, I'll say more. So, a lot of ways we actually start out by anchoring, and this is why the first noble truth is really important, I think. And anchoring, you know, and then the first noble truth also isn't just an intellectual thing, right? The practice discussion. Practice instruction of the first noble truth is to investigate. Or another way to put it is to acknowledge, right? To realize what is actually true and present. And so it helps us anchor, because we can't solve a problem until we clarify what it is and we agree on what it is. And that's where a lot of the conflict is, when you say agreeing what the problem is. Once we, as a group or a coalition or two people, or even within myself, when I agree on what the issue is or that I want to address, then I have much more of a sense of what is the AA or the correct or the appropriate response. So today I want to give us a more holistic framing of this kind of being with the first noble truth. So a way in which to support how we can reframe our view and thus acknowledge things as they are. So you all have probably heard of the Indra's net. Have you heard of Indra's net? Yes, no, some.
No.
Okay, Indra's net is a teaching from the Avatamsaka Sutra. It is a Mahayana Sutra. And it's actually it's also translated as the flower ornamental. And it's one in which everything is very ornamental. And it's describes the Pure Land, and it describes kind of how the world can be when it is very imaginative. Kind of like if things were perfect, right? But there's definitely teachings there, right? And one of the teachings is from the god of Indra, who says that in the cosmos is made up of a vast interconnection. And usually the depiction you'll see when you Google it or look it up, is that it's like a spider web. And that in each of the node of the spider web is a jewel. So that's like each of us. And as jewels, or the being of jewel, right, is that it has many facets. And when you look at a jewel, it reflects. So the whole idea is that if I'm a jewel and Cass is a jewel and, remember your name?
Henry.
Oh, now I recognize you. Henry. It's true, right? It's a little harder. So Henry, so we're jewels. So then if we were jewels, then looking at me, you'll see a reflection of Henry and you'll see a reflection of Cass. And in fact, all of us, right? So it's a way in which we are interconnected, and that's the main teaching of it. Sounds great, doesn't it? And in fact, that is a way in which it says that this is how we are one, because we reflect each other. And I want to propose to you that we overemphasize the jewels, the individual, and we need to actually look at the whole net, which is all the strands between the nodes. And those are the interconnections. And in fact, if a jewel has had more resources, right, then it swells up bigger and bigger and actually creates stress on the net itself, and at time can even break parts of the net. Or it shines so bright, we've seen this in certain individual, that it, you know, you can't see any other jewels, right? It takes up so much space that the rest of us are, you know, not seeing. So if we focus much more on the net, right, how then we balance things out? And where is there a gap in the net that we need to fix? So it's a restorative model. Actually, it's both in restoration, it's a model in which it says, when we see something is broken or wrong or dukkha or torn, then it's actually we're going, there was wholeness here. How do we get back to wholeness? How do we restore wholeness? How do we restore the connections between us? So it's a way in which we can see wholeness as, I'm not saying we forget the individual and the jewels, because that's me, and that's you, and that's important. And what's we also need to remember is that it's our relationship, it's our connection that makes, like Sangha, right? Mm-hmm. Sangha isn't just about you all just sitting here, right, in your spot, right? There's some kind of connection that we have. And that comes because we talk to each other, we listen to each other, we have tea. Cass brought me tea, Shinsen drove me here, right? These are connections to make me, to support how I'm here in this moment, right here and right now. My karmic arising doesn't happen on my own. All right. Now, for yourself, imagine so think of a spider web, and you know how in the middle there's a spot. So you're now, if you want to close your eyes, you can. You're now in the middle. That's you. And then think out through the net at the nodes, maybe at the end, just to make it easy. Not a very complicated spider web. So just at far ends of the node, just think of people, beings, organization, like the Sangha here, as content, you could say, or at things that are important to you. So imagine that. These are things that are important to you, that makes you feel enlivening. And now, you know, think about, what is it that supports that? Does it go both ways? Is there a strength in that, and where perhaps it might be weakened? Right? Perhaps you just had a fight with your partner before you came, or your partner, you know, X, Y, or Z. maybe that's what kind of strengthening might be needed later today. So that's one way to think of it. And then, you know, just to really feel both the strong connections and the weakened connections. Okay, open your eyes whenever you're ready. So then, skillful view, you can think of as really so much of our practice of skillful view is to understand the Four Noble Truths and karma much, much more. And part of that is to open up our point of view more and more, to see where we haven't seen before, or to go where we haven't gone before, in terms of our understanding. This is what wisdom is, right? When we start to understand more and more what keeps us connected, what's important to us, what our values are, and how do we make that happen. So perhaps, I like to say that we could reframe it, and sometimes it is called that the net of Indra versus Indra's net, even the term, right? Indra's net. Indra's the important one, and the net is secondary. And when you think of the net of Indra, then you realize that there's a whole support network there. So we wake up. We wake up to seeing the interconnection between all of us. And so in terms of the earth, you wake up to, I'll propose to you that we wake up to see that we're stewards of the earth. Right? Instead of the earth serving us, how are we serving the earth or caring for the earth? So, ways of practicing the sense of interconnection. So how do we practice to realize that we are interconnected? And in that, so how do we use our wisdom to enact ethical conduct or compassionate conduct? Or how does our practice support us to have skillful means to put into action? So one is our meditation practice, of course. It really helps us to settle, so that we can be more clear about what the problems are. And that the irony in some ways, I think, is that we actually learn to disconnect from the content. For instance, I was just going to say this, and let's see, I have some other notes. Did I have an example of this? I have some other things to say about it, but I'll just say, obviously, I was late. And Shinsen, very nicely, was going to pick me up, right? 10 o'clock, I live in TL Civic Center. I've got plenty of time on an early Sunday morning, right? So I'm out there. I'm early. I text her. Right. I'm sorry, is it okay if I talk about this? She's used to me talking about things that just happened. But I should check, right? And usually I end up, it's about how I mess up and rethink things. So it's not about Shinsen, it's about me, right? So I even text her and I say, I'm ready early, right? So I'm down there waiting, and 10 o'clock comes up. And I keep looking in the car, right? And then I call her and say, hey, I'm here. Because I'm a very responsible person. I told Jeff I would be here by 10:15, right? Which I thought would be plenty of time to, you know, get my seat and all that and my tea. And, just got her voicemail. So I'm, And, you know, we had text last night, but I did not get an answer that she got my text. And sometimes our texts don't come through right away because we have different kinds of phones, you know. So I'm starting to go, what should I do? You know, I even went upstairs and, like, my girlfriend, like, I might need to borrow your car, you know. And then, of course, then I get the text. Yeah, two cars are behind her that she had to find people to move, right? Blocking her driveway, right? So, and she said, I'll be there in 5. So I go down, and it's now 12:12. I'm like, right? We get here, I'm just in time, and bad with me.
Greg
was like, oh, you're arrived. Perfectly fine. You're on time, right? So I go to sit down, and, you know, I'm really grateful, actually, that I didn't have to lead a meditation, because then I could just settle. And I would say to you that, I think it's my Zen practice, because we're very body-based. Like, we take the seat. That's what we do to begin our meditation. We, you know, go to the breath. We go to our posture. And we really take the seat, right? And so I kept, of course, the story about how I arrived, being late, you know, my chair creaking, thank you, Henry, for fixing that too. You know, all sorts of stuff, right? The heater going on. At first I was like, oh, the neighbors, you know? And then I felt the warm air. And then, so, you know, the practice was just kept disengaging from the story. This is what I mean when I say the content. Even of the why I'm late. To keep on just coming back to, again, in my lineage and my teaching, the teachings that have come down to me, to just being in the body. And just, in fact, when you know your body, like for instance, I know that my head tends to drift to the left. And every time I remember that, and it's pretty small, but I drift back, I move my head back, then literally a breath fills me and I feel more relaxed. And so it's really about that kind of centering. This is why an anchor point is so important. Mine is posture, yours can be breath, yours can be a mantra or a metta phrase or whatever. So to keep on being able to come back to that anchor so that we disengage from the content. Not because the content isn't valid, just much more, this is how we find settledness that's available in any moment and at any time. And from there, then we have the groundedness to go meet the difficulties of our lives, be them internal difficulties or external difficulties. That was okay, Shinsen?
We arrived.
I'm sorry, what?
We arrived.
We arrived, yes. And she was very kind and dropped me off before she had to go find parking. So, now ritual, being a Zenner, of course, is another way in which we practice actually the subtleness into action. It's actually, ritual is a way of balancing. One way to think of it is a balancing of energy, right? How is it that we enact the motivation that we're going for? And when we do it enough with the intention, then in the doing, that motivation is realized. Make sense? I'll tell you, right? Because of the pandemic, because things are changing, shifting. I actually haven't been at the temple hardly at all. My meditation group, we're Zen and Vipassana, because I mix them, but I'm very laid back about the form, because it can be a hindrance for people. And also, you know, busy tasks, sometimes it doesn't happen. And I'll tell you, I don't bow to my seat in a way very often these days, right? At home, I've gotten lazy and I just sit down when I meditate. Don't tell anybody, right? So when I came, though, you know, probably because of the altar, I'm sure it was, right? This is a temple space for me, right? I bow to the seat. And I turn around and bow to you all. Now, in Zen, we do that because first you bow to the seat because you're saying, this is, I'm in this, I'm enacting awakening. That's really what we do, right? We might not think it, but this in this, I'm going to commit to this period of meditation to enact awakening at the seat. at this moment, at this place. And then we turn around and we bow to the room, which is really the assembly. But in Zen, of course, everyone is facing the wall, so it's not like people looking at you. And so we're actually saying, and then I'm going to do that with all of you. And even in the seat, we're saying, I'm going to do it, but to all the people who have done it at the seat before. And then in Zen, actually, if there's two people to the side, they're watching for you, and when you arrive, they bow too. And so when you do that bow to the seat, they bow, because it's acknowledgement that we're all doing this together. And I'll tell you that when I came and I did that, right away it also had a solemnness. It was momentary, as I told you during the meditation, I had all those thoughts, right? But each moment in which we enact, which is another way to put that is we commit to, and then we do it. That's what I like to think of an act. It's my vow and the doing of the vow, or motivation, if vow sounds too big. Right? This is my intention, and this is how I'm manifesting my intention. So it helps to balance one's energy. Bowing supports us to, really, Suzuki Roshi said, you know, it is very much to overcome your ego. Because it is a practice of humbleness and humility in a positive way. And of course, as many of you know, that's a bow to like the altar, be it a ritual or just as a prostration. But it's also when we bow to each other, then we're bound to the Buddha in you, or your capacity for awakening, and you bound to me, is we're acknowledging each other's capacity for awakening. And then in Zen, people have seen us, right, in the full prostration, we come down and then we put our hands like this and we bring it above our ears and down. Do you know what that is? The Buddha is standing on my hand and I'm lifting the Buddha up. This is why you don't go... Really, that's what they teach you. Do not go, just kick them over, right? And that's why the hands go straight up. And it's gentle. You don't go, you know. It's gentle. So notice, you know, you might have seen it and you thought, oh God, you know, all these rituals, what the they're doing, right? Really, these are ways of enacting what's important. Right? This is a sense actually of gratitude. Right? I venerate the teachings of the Buddha. Right? I have gratitude. It's not that we're less than, it's much more that this is, and we all know this, right? When we care about each other, even when we shake, and I like to say there's bowing in Western, you know, sometimes people think bowing is so Eastern, but bowing is also very Western. Every time we shake our hand, we're going, that's a bowing. This is our form of bowing. When someone you care about, you know, even across the room you nod, that's a little bow, right? So bowing is this way in which we say, hey, I see you, I respect you. We venerate each other in that moment. And it reminds us that we don't do this alone, and actually we never have. And then of course there's the aspect of not self, or non-duality, or this interbeing, which another way to put it in terms of activism or a bigger structure is coalition building, or a collective sense. And now chanting is one of those. And Zen, we say you don't chant with your mouth, you chant with your ears. Because when we chant, there's one person that leads the chant called the Kokyo, right? And they're the loudest voice, and they should only be the loudest voice. And they're loud at a certain time, like to introduce. And then when the rest of us have gotten a little off, like too low in energy in the chant, or the tone isn't quite, then they become louder to raise. But the rest of us are just, we chant with our ears because we're trying to harmonize with each other. We're not here to say, hey, I know this chant better than you, and, right? It's to go, hey, how do we harmonize with each other in this chant? And it's actually a really lovely practice at first, because many of us, when we're uncomfortable with not knowing, we become very competitive. Or maybe I should say I. When I'm uncomfortable and with not knowing, I can get rather competitive, right? And so it's a practice in which I set down my competitive. It's not a problem to be competitive. How can I practice meeting my not knowing with a sense of harmonizing and coalition building, you could say, as opposed to aggressive? For me, it's aggressive to be competitive, right? Or it can be. All right. So, again, from the World Food Program. They said, for the community supported by the World Food Program, these record-breaking changes have meant increased hunger at a time when humanitarian budgets are tightening. Today, nearly 350 million people face acute food insecurity worldwide. Yet in 2022, they received only two-thirds of the funding needed. Most devastating of all, those suffering the worst impacts did little to cause the damage. The 20 countries on the International Rescue Committee 2023 emergency watch list, including drought-hit Somalia and flood-hit Pakistan, contribute only 2% of global greenhouse gas emissions. In December, when Dubai hosts the 28th UN Climate Change Conference, and this is from Gunnar Lagande, the director of World Food Program, WFP, he says, we hope that the climate summit in 2023 will see much more concrete commitments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and help the most vulnerable communities on the climate front lines to protect ourselves from loss and damage. A key principle of loss and damage funding should be that it is directed to local efforts and initiatives, starting with the most vulnerable first. First and foremost, this funding needs to go to solutions which protect local communities from harm and avoid them becoming dependent on debt, aid, or charity. With 1 in 23 people worldwide likely to need help to survive this year, scaling up climate adaptation solutions for vulnerable communities is more crucial than ever. Those needs will only mount as the planet heats up. And in April of this year, scientists are probably going to issue that we're 1.15 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average, which is close to the 1.5, so it's 1.15, which is really close to 1.5, that in 2015 we agreed that we would get to, right? So the unabated rise in global temperatures and resulting increase in climate-related disasters is pushing the humanitarian effort system to breaking point, Maganda says. We urgently need the funding and systems in place to scale up climate adaptation solution and food systems, combining hazard forecasting with physical and financial protection. They do have a climate insurance program, just like subsidies, essentially, to help those affected most, that climate crisis affects their crops. And then they also want to put into action early warning system to provide assistance to people at risk before disasters strike. Lagonda ends with, this year, as in 2023, is bound to be another challenging year for tackling climate change. But with renewed energy from communities, governments, scientists, and development partners, 2023 can also be a year of good news and transformation, he adds. We have the power to create a better, more sustainable future. All right, I want to end with, so now, think again about that spider web. And this time, what if you put the earth in the middle? Not yourself, but the earth. Not that anything's wrong with yourself. But what if you include this other web, that the earth is in the middle? And then think about what aspects would help. And then think about how the strands for me are ways in which that can happen. And then just in a spider web, you know, there are many nodes on the way. So for instance, you know, I was thinking myself, right? I really have been, because who raised our food, right, is affected, is impacted a lot, right? And so, can we buy local? That would be one thing. How do we perhaps buy organic? Because those pesticides that go into the waters also affect, right? They impact the ecosystem at the edges of waterways, and then that breaks down, and that contributes actually to drought. There's lots of stuff around the Sacramento area, right, around this. So just ways in which, like, can I commit to buying more organic? You know, myself, having, you know, been in much low income for many of my years, sometimes I think of organic as, you know, just for the rich people. I admit that, you know. And so, you know, I want to really make more commitment to that, because one, it's much more accessible now too, right? So just where is it that, you know, different values, this is the complexity of life, right? Is that, yeah, there are different values working, and how do we make them work, right? Which includes trying out different things or making commitment and then making adjustment. So those nodes on the way are also can be small steps to achieving whatever your end goal is to support the earth. And then last, this is from, I was at a Buddhist Peace Fellowship gathering, and one of the co-leaders named B, I got this quote from her. She says, or this is a West African quote I got from her. When spider webs unite, they can tie up a lion. When spider webs unite, they can tie up a lion. Tie up a lion. Right? That's strong. Spider webs are really strong. All right. Thank you for your attention and listening.
Thank you.
I don't know if we have time for any comments or questions.
Yes, we do. Well, thank you for the reminder of the connection to everyone, not just the Sangha. I mean, growing up as a gay man or gay boy, seeing the separation and feeling the separation is at first, you know, a cause of suffering, but it's then a sort of a way of empowerment. It's like, you think I'm different. Honey, you're so right. And so it's difficult sometimes because we have a culture of that kind of emphasizes maybe assessment, let's say, not judgment. And separation. And so I read a poem recently that was really powerful, but it was basically made the point that when I'm irritated by people, when people do things that, you know, are cause me inconvenience, I forget that they're all going to die. Mm-hmm. You know, and that has kept me, every time I kind of encounter anger or irritation, I try to come back to that thought, you know, that we are really sharing this experience of life and consciousness together. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to share. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you for your sharing. Should we see if anyone online might have a question?
Yes, anybody online have?
So I don't really have a question, but I just wanted to thank you for the your Dharma talk, which has been certainly the most meaningful for me in a number of years, probably since Sylvia Borstein before the pandemic. And that's been because it connected to me as a ordinary person was struggling to do Buddhist practice for many years, and it was just the kinds of experience that ordinary people have who are not awakened. So thank you.
You're welcome. And I will say, at least in Zen, we say we wake up to being ordinary. You know that, right? We're not humans trying to be spiritual beings, or spiritual beings trying to be human. I can't remember who said that. Not me.
Well, you just did say
it. I get to speak it. It's not my original thought. A French person. I can't pull up his name. Yes.
Well, yes. A basic question. Who is Indra in Indra's net?
Indra's the god of all the other gods. The koan in which the blade of grass, do you guys know that one too? That's Indra. Oh, there's a koan that says, they're walking with the Buddha, and the Buddha, I can't pull up the exact koan, but basically, how do we have a place, right? So then a blade of grass is planted and the sanctuary grows, right? And Indra's the god of all the gods, from the Vedic tradition. Yeah.
Okay. No further questions, comments? Thank you.
All right, thank you, Chris. And everyone.
Do we have any announcements? We have a host today?
I am a host. So please stay and enjoy being with each other. There's hot tea for water, and if you have tea or just hot water, you can put them in the dishwasher. It's not full of clean things. And if it is, you can just put them in the sink. I'll go around with the Dharma bowl. Dharma is the word for, I don't remember.
Generosity.
Generosity, thank you. So your generosity is appreciated. I will go around collecting your Dharma, and the suggested amount is $10 to $20, and it helps us do the things we do, like rent the space, have the honoraria, eventually maybe do the dinners again at Larkin Street, and the newsletter, which is mailed out mostly to people who are incarcerated in the system we have, the pipeline to incarceration, whatever it is. If you're new and you would like to get the emails and be on our directory, you can sign up out there on the credenza. And some people go to lunch after we're all done, around 12:30, and they meet at the front.
And you can also donate online through the gaybuddhist.org website. There's a comment from...
I have an announcement.
Yes, please.
So Access to Zen, we meet on Monday nights. We are doing a series, reading the book Transcending, Uplifting... Oh, no, I had the Uplifting. Trans-Buddhist Voices, in response to all the direct hatred and violence and policies against trans right now. We are having some of the people in the book be guests. Like Lev White is coming on the 15th of May. And we meet on the first and third Mondays in person, and we're always online. There's a little break. I don't know if you guys know who Chen Sing Han is. She wrote Be the Refuge. She has a new book out called One Long Listening. She was a Buddhist chaplain. So she's coming to talk on the first.
And where is this?
We are actually currently right down the street near Ezra Mendy. You know the Brazilian restaurant? We're upstairs. One of our members has been painting studios there. So it's online at accessdesign.org. Yeah, come join us online always.
Okay. Yep. And I'll share a comment from Lee Robbins online. Also interesting that your Dharma talk reminded me of the person whom I have found my most accessible and immediately meaningful Buddhist teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh. Also, mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. That's a big compliment. I'll take it.
So we'll gather for our dedication of merit. Would you like to do one, or should we use our...
Please.
Okay.
Oh,
by the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness, which is without sorrow, and may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.